my son wasn't given a chance to live. I have a chance to live, so I will risk whatever it takes to say his name.
Marcus Brown! Say my son's name, Marcus Brown! Say my son's name, Marcus Brown!
I don't know all of their names, but what I do tell you is I stand for all the mothers out here who lost their sons to police brutality.
Justice!
Now! Justice! Now!
The unprecedented movement to defund the police has brought a critical debate about the role of a powerful coercive state agency into the mainstream of political discussion. It has raised the question about how the police functions everywhere and whose interests they serve. But the police are not the only coercive arm of the state. What about the military, homeland security, prisons, the intelligence agencies? Isn't it time to put those agencies also under the spotlight and examine whose interests they serve? For 10 years, TNI has published a yearly State of Power report to examine who has power in the world today, how they use their power, and how those committed to social and environmental justice should respond. Most of our editions have focused on corporate power, responding to the trend of ever more concentrated corporate power and the way it has shaped economic policy and had massive social and cultural impacts. Yet, alongside the rise of corporations, the last few decades have also seen a significant strengthening of coercive state forces, especially in the wake of 9/11. Military spending has doubled, world prison numbers have increased 24%, and border agencies have grown exponentially. State security forces not only escaped the post-2008 austerity crunch that afflicted nearly every other state agency, they often boomed without restraint. The rise of surveillance and data technologies has provided many of these agencies with capacities to monitor and control populations that were inconceivable in the last century. How are we to understand the history, trajectory, current state, and likely future of coercive state power? How does it differ in countries in the global North and South? How does geopolitics and the rise of big tech shape coercive state power? What alternatives exist that can return power to the people? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. In today's episode, I'm joined by colleague and editor of State of Power, Nick Buxton. And to help us tackle these questions and more, we invited two prominent thinkers with deep and interesting perspectives on these issues. Achille Mbembe is a groundbreaking philosopher who has profoundly woken people to the deadly costs of racial capitalism over four decades of work. And Olufemi Taiwo, a thinker and prolific writer whose theoretical work draws liberally from the Black radical tradition and anti-colonial thought. Both our guests are very public philosophers and have written extensively on the intersections of racial capitalism, climate justice, and colonialism. In this wide-ranging conversation, they help us to understand modern-day coercive state power, tracing its roots in colonialism and examining the way it has shaped our contemporary security institutions. My colleague Nick set the conversation going.
My first question to you both is, why has this become an age of rising authoritarian state control? It seemed a few decades ago we were kind of, the predictions were we were moving away from a world of authoritarianism, the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was repression in places like Tiananmen Square, but a sense that the world was opening up, and yet it seems we're going in a different direction. So how do you describe the kind of reasons for this kind of rise of authoritarian state control, not just from authoritarian regimes, but within supposedly liberal regimes as well? And perhaps I could start with you, Achille.
This is a very complex question. One way of looking at it would be to argue that maybe for the first time since the end of the Second World War, we now realize the extent to which capitalism on the one hand and democracy on the other hand have in fact always been at loggerheads. In the aftermath of the Second World War, both systems came to a kind of compromise, which translated into what we used to call the welfare state and its different manifestations in different parts of the world. Both systems also signed a kind of tacit peace in the sense that colonial systems were brought to an end, and at least at the international system level, a number of new states were integrated in a compact, which was still, of course, hierarchized in the sense that there was no equality of sovereignty. But what we have seen, I would say, since the end of the 20th century, with, first of all, so-called globalization, but more importantly, with the ongoing transformations of neoliberalism, what we have seen is that both democracy and, to some extent, the state itself have been, as many have argued, hollowed out. They have been hollowed out through a number of mechanisms, debt being one of them. The fact that states themselves have become indebted to corporations, corporate power, so forth and so on. This has led to a new situation in which, indeed, what remains of the state is mostly composed of coercive resources, a coercive apparatus, which itself is now more and more put at the service of an economic system, the main function of which is to trade on life as such. And this has, of course, resulted in the acceleration of predatory practices. And it seems to me that it is at the intersection of these predatory take on life as such, technologization of the world, the plundering of the planet, it is at the intersection of these multiple crises that lies the explanation to, let's say, the authoritarian turn, including of so-called liberal democracies.
Femi, perhaps would you like to kind of add to that? What's your understanding? Thank you, Ashil.
Yeah, my understanding is quite similar. I suppose the only thing that it occurs to me to add is the larger backdrop of, you know, the longer history of the five or so centuries of colonialism that the post-World War II period represents a stage within. So as of now, as we speak, there are, I believe, 193 member states of the United Nations. On the eve of the Second World War, there were 35. The British Empire alone controlled a quarter of the world's population and its landmass. And the organization of the colonies in much of the world was under very explicit authoritarianism, you know, ruled by a strong executive power with few checks, and with what checks there were being internal to the colonizers' apparatus, explicit systems of racial apartheid. I think the expectation that we were going to go to a period of freedom and liberal democracy that lived up to itself after 1989 reflects generations that lived in a quite exceptional time in the development of global colonial control. The grounds for that exception geopolitically were, of course, the battle lines between the U.S. allied states and the Soviet Union allied states that made up the Cold War. But the understanding of that conflict as a conflict between, you know, the freedom-loving liberal democracy parts of the world and the freedom-hating part of the world is, of course, a nonsensical one. If, you know, one clear reason why that's so is because many of the, you know, now 193 member states were under the direct colonial control of the so-called liberal democracies, under racially hierarchized, explicitly autocratic, imperial, fascist methods of control. And so I think from that point of view, from that longer story, in the absence of a third world whose hearts and minds are in play, geopolitically speaking, at the level of ideology, when trying to win converts to this or that side of the Cold War's ideological fault lines, it's not surprising at all that what followed from 1989 wasn't a period of serious liberal democracy and freedom, but unfettered state repression and unfettered private repression as the space of the governance of social life was increasingly ceded from the public to the private in the neoliberalization of the world economy. Indeed, it's the opposite that would have been surprising if the world genuinely moved to a system of serious freedom for everyone in the absence of ideological competition between two rival ways of organizing the world and two rival state powers that aim to organize the world in that way.
Perhaps you could, I just want to kind of at this point just deepen the conversation about the kind of role of colonialism, that kind of longer history, but both in terms of more generally the kind of practices and the way the state was organized and the trajectory of how society was policed, and the rise of particular institutions, the way that they rose within colonial contexts. And perhaps Sean could, do you want to frame a question here around really that to identify the linkages between coercive state power and its roots in colonialism and its relevance still today?
Yes, in the present, what we're seeing is a period which is being defined as colonialism has ended, right? This is the accepted history is colonialism ended. There might be some vestiges of it, but then it's actually really an era in the past. But what we're seeing is, of course, those systems of power still exist. But there's an extra player involved now, which is the indigenous leadership. How do we understand this sort of native colonialism? These local leaders who are not working in the interests of their people, but rather not necessarily also directly in the interests of global capital. So just that interplay, that added factor. I don't know if that question makes sense. Femi, do you want to start on that?
Yeah, I can say a bit. I'm sure Ashir will have more to say. But I think, again, placing the fact of sort of indigenous involvement, we could say, in larger colonial structures, in the longer history of colonialism, whether we're talking about European colonialism or the last five centuries, or if we're going back even further in history, that is actually the norm rather than the exception, right? It is difficult for empires to project power outside of actual geographic terrain and social terrain that they understand. And they often find it strategic to divide sections of the population against each other by empowering one section of the population, or just to rule in a more directly autocratic way, but recruit natives into middle management positions. Indeed, you know, things like the transatlantic slave trade could not have happened were it just the Europeans' knowledge of trade networks and social relations that were brought to bear on African societies. So I think the first step is to put that history, this new history, in a longer history. So what is new and what we should acknowledge is new and different is the formalization in the state, or rather as the state, of what amounts to middle management positions from the point of view of the state system as a whole. So increasingly important aspects of global social structure that define large patterns in production, economic production, and distribution of wealth. Increasingly, these are decided either at multinational levels through the, you know, Bretton Woods institutions and related institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which are not under the control of any particular state, but which are susceptible to differences in geopolitical stature and power and influence. But also, in keeping with what we're talking about more generally, a lot of those decisions aren't made by states at all. So part of the goal of institutions like International Monetary Fund, particularly in the age of structural adjustment, but alive and well today in forms like the Doing Business Index, is to economically liberalize these countries, which is to facilitate essentially the transnational governance capacity of capital itself and capital as organized in the form of the corporation. So it is, you know, Microsoft and Motorola and Alphabet and steel manufacturers and big agribusiness that are in the serious kind of final analysis, at least from a materialist perspective, governing in many parts of the world. And unless and until we grapple with that, I don't think we'll be in a position to understand what the role of the state has to be in this new phase of world history and struggle for justice.
And Achille, your thoughts? Thank you so much, Femi.
I think Femi explained it extremely well. Of course, they have been, let's say, decolonization. Formal decolonization has happened in waves. Latin America, late 19th century, early 20th. Asia, mid 20th century, Africa, mostly 60s onwards. But one has to remind oneself that, in fact, until the tail end of the 20th century, places such as South Africa were still under one form of colonialism or another. They called it here a colonialism of a special kind. Until the last quarter of the 20th century, Southern Africa at large, shown Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Namibia, Angola, were still caught in the quagmire of a rather vicious form of colonialism, settler colonialism, predicated on the idea that certain races are superior to others. So some kind of decolonization has happened, but this doesn't mean, as we speak, that colonialism as such has ended. Some parts of the world are still under colonial occupation, either from an external power or as a result of either partition or it's a occupation again by their own state. Think of places like Kashmir, Palestine, and others. And even if we agreed that our world, our planet at large is now decolonized, it wouldn't mean that coloniality as such has ended. What is really important is coloniality, is the political epistemic core, a certain mode of ruling people deemed superfluous, people deemed both indispensable and dispensable, because that's what racial rule, in any case, in these parts of the world used to be. We need your muscles, we value your work, your labor, we want your labor, we want it seriously, but at the same time, we entitle ourselves to dispose of you the way we want. So these dialectics of dispensability and indispensability, which today it seems to me, and then too, but today in an accelerated way, has paved the way for what I would call a politics of abandonment, a politics of neglect, where historically colonialism had to do with the conquest and occupation and exploitation of faraway lands and faraway people with whom we didn't really have much to do with, nothing, let's say, related us to them. So instead of that, what we have now are new forms of internal colonialism, which allow the dominant classes to rule over their own people as if the latter were their enemies.
I wanted to follow up very quickly there. You mentioned the internal colonization, where this, the new leaders sort of see their own people as an enemy. And this is kind of this is what I'm trying to understand myself, because when I talk to fellow Zimbabweans, for instance, their oppressor is not a white person. It's not. It's hard to see global capital. It's a it's fellow black folk. In this world then that we're in, what role then does racism play? Is anti-racism core to an emancipatory agenda, or do we have to formulate liberation somewhat differently if now we don't have this explicit authoritarian, racist, racial capitalist system that Femi also very clearly outlined? How do we understand then the anti-racist struggle?
Femi, do you want to take the lead on that?
Yeah, I can say a couple of things. One thing I've been thinking about recently is developing a politics that is genuinely structural, and a political understanding that is genuinely structural. I think the tendency in a lot of ways of conceiving of politics is to think, you know, how we understand the role of identity in politics is as telling us who's bad and who's good, who's the oppressor and who's the oppressed, who is the victim and who is the victimizer. And for reasons that we've already discussed, right, any sensible history of colonialism shows the contribution of kind of middle managers from the oppressed class. Any sensible history of slavery shows the role of complicit merchants and abductors who themselves were Africans. For reasons of this kind, I think that's never been a way of framing politics that was accurate. But I think also for the reasons that we're talking about, the development of neocolonialism, the politics of abandonment rather than the politics of more direct forms of domination, I think it makes less sense in this age than it ever has. And so really what we now are confronted with is developing a politics of race and everything else, where we are genuinely thinking structurally. For me, a sensible structural approach to thinking about what race is and what racism is and what we're trying to combat is politics of outcomes. What race is, globally speaking, is essentially a kind of stratification in different outcomes, different levels of security. If you look at how housing insecurity is distributed across the world and not just within a country, you'll see stark racial divisions. If you look at how susceptibility to violence and incarceration are distributed, again, globally, you will see stark racial divisions. And the reasons for that are complicated, and you have to drill down very much into the specific issues that you're thinking about. And the solutions will be just as complicated, because it's not as simple as putting someone who looks like you in power, for the very reason Sean was just explaining, right? That's no solution of any kind. You know, what we have to do are find less predatory ways of structuring our political world such that we defend each other's safety and not some people's profit margins or some people's pretensions to control or some people's need for a kind of social structure built on coloniality, as Ashil explains.
Awesome. Thank you, Femi. Ashil, do you have something to add?
Maybe just in line with what Femi is telling us, it seems to me that there are varying modes of violence which are inflicted nowadays over, of course, specific categories of populations, blacks, minorities, women, so forth and so on, but even more broadly over what we could call the planetary populace. Just witness the kind of brutalities which are committed by state apparatuses, the military, the police, immigration, criminal justice departments, not only in the West, but also elsewhere. The increasing brutalization of very often the most vulnerable in our midst. The call for brutality against those who can hardly defend themselves. So it seems to me you have that kind of, let's just call it machinic violence, a kind of violence whose exertion is, let's say direct, it is immediate, it is visible. Its effects are very often murderous. We saw it with George Floyd, Taylor Breonna, many. I mean, the list is endless. The murderous effects are, of course, individual, but they are also massive. They apply to masses of people dislocated and settled, sent on the road of endless exoduses. So we have that. But we also have another kind of violence that is indirect, which is slow, which is distant, almost imperceptible. It might not always trigger an immediate response from the masses. In fact, it has been conceptualized as slow violence by some analysts. I have here in mind Rob Nixon's work, in which he defines this kind of violence as occurring gradually and out of sight, a kind of violence of delayed destruction. Let's just call it that way. It is dispersed across time and all of that. It seems to me that racism in our times inhabits these two poles, the immediate one and the slow delayed one. And together they form something like an attritional apparatus which attacks not only the body, but also the nerves, which proceeds through, let's say, the usual means of brutalization, but which is also more and more technologized, more and more algorithmic. That algorithmic forms of racism, I think, are the forms of racism of our future. If only because of the technological escalation this period of our history is undergoing. So this raises all sorts of huge questions, Sean. Confront these forms of racism which operate through technologies, nanotechnologies, through forms of, I would call them, mutant powers, which irradiate and which have become viral. The coming together of the radioactive and of the viral. It seems to me that that's where contemporary racism lies, in this interconnection between the radioactive and the viral. How do we fight it? I don't know, but that seems to me to be the challenge.
I'd like to just pick up, Ashir. I'd like to kind of come back to a bit the issues around the technolization and algorithmic racism and oppression. I was just wondering if we could go back a little bit to kind of your, what you consider the kind of the agents of brutality. And I kind of want to pass out a bit more what you see as the different role of the police, the military, the border guard, and perhaps the other institutions that are part of a coercive state apparatus that we don't always identify as such, the ones that legitimize it. And just to hear from both of you, if we're to understand coercive state power, who are the agents? How are we to understand their kind of emergence as increasingly the ones to respond to any kind of social ill or social division? We kind of pass that back increasingly to agents, not of cohesion, but ones of brutality. So perhaps you could just continue on that thread, Ashil, a bit about the agents, and then I'd also love to hear Femi's thoughts about how are we to understand the different roles of these different agencies of brutality.
Look, I'm really not sure about what I'm talking about here. I don't know whether Femi is in a different disposition. I'm just exploring. I'm thinking aloud, if you want. So in that spirit of thinking aloud, I would think that the agencies of brutalization have become more decentralized than they have ever been before. They have become ever more abstract in the sense that, of course, they still proceed via the traditional apparatuses of the state, some of which I listed early on. The police. The police has never been as militarized as it is today. The judicial system, Olu mentioned early on, the carceral system, modes of capture and incarceration. But one has to add to that the increasing role played by programming. Because key to technological escalation is programming. Programming as a modality of redistribution of brutality, programming is abstract. It proceeds through coding. You code people, you turn them into numbers. But that was yesterday. We used to turn individuals into numbers. We have gone even further. We turn them into a code that is the object of storage, a object of datification. They become data. They become part of big data which is then more amenable to circulation, velocity, and all those properties we see, including the work of capital itself, especially finance capital. So there is this dematerialization of the state itself as it cedes some of its very functions to these technologies, which seem neutral, which seem objective, but in fact are not. So it seems to me maybe what I'm saying is that if we want to rise up against these new techno systems, we need, as Suzanne George, whom you quoted early on, study not only the powerful, but the means by which control, especially control and destruction of those who are deemed to be superfluous, how it operates, how it has been outsourced to new machines. Although, of course, we still have a policeman grabbing a black man on a pavement in Minnesota and administering death to the latter by putting his knee on his neck. All of that is still going on, but it is buttressed by the technologies I've been talking about.
Fermi, would you like to kind of respond to that and also just share a little bit about where you see the emergence of these, I guess also linking back to the colonial conversation about coloniality, how these institutions emerge in coloniality and how they both inherit that, but also are changing as Ashiel is sharing.
Yeah, I think it makes sense, you know, we're rightly incensed by, you know, these images, right? The officer on George Floyd's neck, or for that matter, the officer in Barreiros in Brazil, who stood on a black woman's neck there. But I think these kind of, you know, one question we should ask after looking at this spectacular violence is about the violence that isn't spectacular, right? I think what Ashiel's saying is helpful about the programmatic nature of this violence and the increasingly algorithmic nature of this kind of slow violence. But I think what else, you know, to relate it to colonialism, I think one question to ask is a functional question. What is it that police exist to do as such? What is the institution for? In the Atlantic contest, or at least, you know, the west part of the Atlantic, where the U.S. is, but also the Caribbean and Central and South America, North America in general, I think the answer to the question is pretty clear. There are a number of institutional antecedents to the police. They are slave patrols and labor discipline, broadly construed, including the surveillance and discipline of immigrants in the northeastern of the United States, who would have been from the lower European stocks of people, as they might have been thought of at the time, and including enslaved people in the Caribbean and the south of the United States and in South America. Put in the backdrop of that history, and even the more recent trends, I think one way, the way that I've been thinking about policing these days is as distributors of insecurity, right? Or you could say, for the same token, distributors of security, right? But they don't exist to make society safe as a whole. They exist to make certain people, certain elements, certain actions in society safe, which is quite different. There are a lot of stark examples of this, but, you know, as a Nigerian American person, and just given how large and how long and how influential the NSARS protests were, I think looking at Nigeria makes some sense. Afrobarometer did a survey of the Nigerian population, and respondents to the survey said something like more than three quarters of respondents had paid bribes to the police. Many of them had paid bribes just to get regular police assistance. So it's very difficult to understand an institution that is functioning like that as a site of extortion rather than as a securing presence. It's hard to understand that kind of institution as being about, you know, serving and protecting, as they say here in the States. And so once we think of this aspect of coercive state power as about distributing security by distributing insecurity, right, carrying guns to make it unsafe for some people to be targeted by crime, clear connections between this and what Ashiel was saying before about a politics of abandonment, I think, emerge. It's no longer contradictory or even, you know, or even a tension that a lot of times the rise of militarized policing and carcerality and coloniality in policing institutions arise as the welfare state recedes. Because both of those are actually moving in the same direction to make some people secure while and by means of the insecurity of other people.
Thanks, Femi. I mean, are the military and police indistinguishable as both being, or the police or a border guard, are they essentially all fulfilling that same role, or do you see particular differences as they all play a role in distributing insecurity? Some people talk about the militarization of police, but perhaps that's misunderstanding that the police are really essentially having the same role as the military. It's not that there's one becoming the other. They both serve different functions of the same thing. I was just wondering how you would...
Yeah, they're different institutions that serve the same function. That's how I would think about it. And so the Border Patrol is geographically bounded, not as geographically bounded as people think, especially in the States, but somewhat geographically bounded. The police are somewhat geographically bounded, and the military is somewhat geographically bounded. But those are the distinctions between those institutions, geographical distinctions, which sometimes give rise to other distinctions in practice, but it's, you know, it's as you said, these institutions serve fundamentally the same function and purpose. And so it's unsurprising that they share tactics, information, resources, and information.
And Ashir, would you like to add something on the different functions of these organs? Or I mean, I guess particularly I've been struck in your writings around how the border and places like the Mediterranean really becoming zones of death, necropolitics, whether there's something we're witnessing there in the kind of emergence of state power, which is both using active means and, as you've said, kind of more kind of programmatic or processes that actually serve the same processes of exclusion and also brutality.
I would add one small point, which has to do with the fact that, I mean, sit down, look around, you see rising in various societies across the world, a new kind of racism are called armed racism. Because one thing for racism to not be armed, yet it's an entirely different thing when racism relies for its reproduction and perpetuation, it relies on the trinity of guns, of Christianity, and of identity. So the emergence of, let's say, armed racism is nothing new, has been there for a long time. And the function of the police or of the army and other coercive arms of the state has to be understood from within that architecture, that emerging, let's say, rearticulations of armed racism worldwide. And here, part of what we see is an increasing blurring of the divisions between these three apparatuses, police, army. When is it that the police begins acting as an army against what kind of enemy? In the traditional political dispensation, the army has to deal with foreign enemies, defending the borders and all that. Police deals with matters of internal order. But as I'm saying, all these orders are now being, let's say, mixed up. The lines supposed to divide the police and the militia, that is also under stress. So what is going on is that we see a worldwide and universal rearrangement of power, and under the light of, Olu didn't use that term, but I use it, discriminatory violence, which leads to, of course, some being put to death prematurely and others not. Call it security or insecurity, if you want. So that is what seems to me to be a driving force behind some of the things we are witnessing, which reminds us once again, as Olu said early on, of colonialism, which was really a laboratory where modern order was, let's say, experimented with.
I was wondering if we could also just build on that and just look your thoughts really on some of the changing dynamics that you see going forward within coercive state power. I'm thinking particularly, you've mentioned already the kind of impact of digital technologies, of datification, and how that might change or how it is already changing policing, militarization, borders, but also some of the other impacts. I know, Femi, you've written about the kind of impacts of climate instability and this rise of this kind of new language of securitization. We know that we live in a world where everything's been increasingly financialized, where also there's shifts in global power with China rising. What do you think are going to be the kind of key trends to kind of keep an eye on that will really shape the reality for social movements struggling for social justice as we go forward in terms of these new dynamics? And perhaps we could start with yourself, Achille, and then hear from Femi.
Maybe two things, maybe. In a book I published a few years ago, I referred to something I called the becoming black of the world, by which I meant something pretty simple. You see, in the Western Atlantic world, under plantation slavery, people deemed to be black used to be ruled under a very specific dispensation, which was called the Black Code. The Black Code was, in short, a juridical dispositive which allowed to treat this specific category of the population in ways nobody else was treated. The Black Codes allowed to treat so-called black people in any way possible. It seems to me that as we go ahead with the increasing crisis of neoliberalism, which now more than ever before has to rely on an illiberal state to buttress its goals, more and more people will be ruled under the Black Code, not just blacks, as it used to be the case before, with all that it entails: wanton violence, disenfranchisement, exposition to all kinds of risks, premature death, enclavement in mortal spaces. In short, the world will be made inhospitable to them, just as it has been made inhospitable for blacks over centuries. So the black conditions will become more and more universalized, if by black condition we refer to what I have just said. And all of this, second point, will be going on as the world is burning, the planet is burning. It has reached its limits. It is becoming more and more inhospitable to life itself. So it seems to me that there is here a line of flight, if you want, or a line of convergence between struggles against racism, but racism redefined in the way I have just tried to do it, racism against species, people defined as species, and ecological struggles, that the two are inseparable. And that if we want to reflect on the question of planetary habitability, which is the question of today and tomorrow, then we have to think seriously about the ways in which we create convergences between struggles against racism and struggles to regenerate the planet. But one last point, one third point, come back to the question of technology. Technology has become our biotope, meaning the milieu, the key environment which will define who we are and as well as our future. There's a new generation of struggles that have to address our technological condition and recapture the technological for purposes not only of human emancipation, but for purposes of emancipation at large, kind of emancipation which includes humans and non-humans, because the fate of the humans is now more than ever before tied to the fate of other species. So that kind of multi-species project, it seems to me, is what is, let's say, required by the times we live in.
Thank you very much, Ashil. I think you really outlaid the kind of big challenge of today and the critical importance of integrating these issues. Femi, your thoughts?
Yeah, I could not possibly agree more with what Ashil just said. And if I could shout it from an air horn everywhere in the world, I would. But, you know, I'll just say a little bit about the specific way that I've been thinking about the kinds of points Ashil just made. I like in particular the connection to Côte Noir and the kind of enduring centuries-long history of this racially stratified global structure that we've inherited. I think one thing that people often maybe acknowledge but don't seem to integrate into their more systemic picture of what the world is and what race is that actually being Black did not mean you were enslaved in the sense of being a chattel slave. It actually, much of the world where transatlantic slavery was practiced, there were populations of freed people. There were mixed race people who often received some mixture of political restrictions and political rights above and beyond what so-called fully Black people received. And I, of course, don't say that to at all diminish the history of racial domination, but to clarify what kind of domination, what kind of a system it was. It wasn't that categorically being Black relegated you to the category of hyper-exploitation and being treated as a site of capital accumulation and chattel property. But it meant that that could happen to you and that it was very likely if you were in the wrong part of the world in the wrong century. Similarly, if we look at the other pole, and I think they're poles rather than binaries, but if we look towards the other pole, racially, up the racial hierarchy, being white didn't mean that you were in charge. It meant that there was a floor, a level of labor exploitation that you wouldn't get below. You wouldn't be treated as property. And it meant that, legally speaking, you could, whatever, become president, become a rich business person. But that the things that were likely to happen to Black people weren't likely to you. Likely to happen to you, weren't likely to happen to you. And I think reconsidering the kind of categorical explanation of race in more probabilistic terms helps make sense of, again, Ruthie Gilmore's definition of slavery as, sorry, of racism as group differences and vulnerability to premature death, and also helps make sense of, I think, Ashil's point that the world in an era of ecological and climate crisis is becoming Blacker in some sense. A lot of the rights and privileges that some people, even people who think about race, have treated as built into whiteness or non-Blackness as such, are in fact contingent responses of the social structure to develop wealth and other bases of social advantages and have the wherewithal to distribute them and distribute in discriminatory ways. So it's because the United States had the wealth that it was able to create a middle class that had economic privileges above and beyond what its racialized underclass had. It's because Nordic countries were able to build a society of fairly thoroughgoing security from various kinds of threats that they were able to convert those into widely held universal freedoms and protections for its populations. Those are contingent upon its geopolitical position, lack of invasion from other people. They were contingent upon its amount of economic production. And they were contingent on the sky, the rain, the air, and the water, things that we've taken for granted in previous centuries and that we will no longer have the luxury of taking for granted in this century. They were contingent upon the plants and the animals, the non-human animals, which again, we were able to take for granted in previous centuries that we thought we were able to take for granted in previous centuries. And we are now realizing how serious of a mistake that was. And so the rights and protections that people think are categorically built into their position in the social hierarchy are in fact the contingent result of these particular ways that the world has developed that are rapidly undeveloping in our very eyes. You know, most of us who are able-bodied and resourced enough had the privilege of going outside unmasked for much of their lives. And lo and behold, many of us find the situation of not being able to do the things that we thought were built into our social position. You know, we find ourselves being denied that expected privilege for reasons that have to do with things happening in the natural world and responses from our social system. That's increasingly going to be the story of the politics of this century. And until we can see our fate as not only linked up with the fate of all those across our actual species and not the fake species that race portrays itself as, but as Ashiel said, the larger ecology, the non-human animals, the plants, the air, the water, until we can see our fates as tied up with those and act accordingly, I think we'll be in trouble.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Femi. I know we're already kind of on the edge of the time that we have, but I wanted to squeeze in a few more questions real quick. Like, in the face of corporate power and market forces, the state, right, is seen as protecting its citizens from capital, right? At least that's how some people formulate it. And you have many movements that are calling for strengthening the public, like to say, let's have more public water, public energy, put more things under public control. But at the same time, those same social movements also face violence from the state. So how should social movements relate to the state? Is it possible to strengthen its capacity for these progressive ends, for instance, redistribution or taking public water, public energy, while without at the same time strengthening this coercive power that we've identified as problematic? So perhaps a quick response to that kind of seems to be a tension there.
So, yeah, I think it's right that there is something of a tension, but I think in resisting taking the tension too seriously, it's worth pointing out that it's not coercive power as such that movements for justice should oppose, right? The Cuban military and the Mozambican Liberation Front and the, you know, fighters of Cape Verde and Angola were and Zimbabwe were also using coercive power in order to rid themselves of colonialism. And so I think sometimes the conversation about coercive power in the guise of the state or anyone else gets excessively moralized. Power in general is a tool, and how we morally evaluate it depends on how it's used, to what ends it's used, rather than, you know, qualitative aspects of the kind of power that it is in the main. But having said that, I think what we should broadly be thinking of is finding ways to exploit the state, and more specifically, exploit the differences in interests between the state as such and capital as such. State and capital have been too buddy-buddy over the past few decades, and the inability of social movements to play one off of the other has led to an alignment in their policies, which the neoliberal consensus represents. And that has led to the politics of abandonment that Ishiel mentioned before, and to contractions in state responsibilities without compensatory gains for most of the people on this earth. And so yeah. I think demands for public power and for assigning the state responsibility for roles that have been taken up by purely extractive corporate colonial institutions is, you know, a good kind of tactical option. And I'll stop there. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Quick, before you go, Femi, is abolitionism a pipe dream? Can we abolish the police? Can we abolish coercive state power?
Yeah, we can abolish lots of things. I think the more interesting question is, you know, should we? Right. I think, you know, I think whatever, especially as Black people, we have faced longer odds in many aspects of our history, and we're still here. And no matter how pessimistic I get about the future, I take solace in that fact and take inspiration from that fact.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Awesome. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
for
a lot. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for listening this far. This has been a conversation featuring contemporary philosophers Achille Mbembe and Olufemi Taiwo on coercive state power. Our gratitude to them for giving us the time to pick their brains on these issues. This is part of a broader report from TNI on coercive state power, and many other articles are available on our website, tni.org. The 2021 report includes articles by writers and activists from all over the world, looking at related themes such as militarization, policing, and counterterrorism. Be sure to check those out by visiting tni.org/stateofpower2021. That is tni.org/stateofpower2021. The articles are not only theoretical, but written to also empower activists and movements to more successfully challenge, confront, and overcome coercive state power that seeks to stop, control, or prevent necessary systemic change. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to give us a rating or a review on whichever platform you're receiving this podcast from. Your feedback will help us to create better content. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and please take a moment today to thank all the special women in your life. See you next time.